Hello and welcome to another episode of The Last Video Store, the show where I, Alexi Toliopoulos, talk to cool, funny, interesting, exciting people about their favorite films in the style of an old school video store rental combo, which includes a staff pick recommendation from my big movie minds based on their taste. And my guest today on the show, one of the all-time great Australian actors, in my opinion. We are joined by the great Damon Herriman. You may know him from Better Man. You may know him from Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, where he plays Charles Manson. You also might know him from Mindhunter, where he also plays Charles Manson. He is touring a new show, a play called Art, with Richard Roxburgh and Toby Schmitz. You can find details of that in the show notes. I love Damon Herriman. Em, you were pumped to have him on the show.
So pumped. I'm a fan.
And he picked up one of my favorite movies of all time. Before we get into our chat, I'm just going to say, come see my live shows at Adelaide, Sydney. Oh, maybe I'm done Adelaide. Come see my live show VHS at Melbourne International Comedy Festival, Sydney Comedy Festival, Brisbane Comedy Festival. Probably going to add Perth. If you saw me in Adelaide, thank you very much. And stick around to the end of the show, because we're going to be talking some of my recommendations to you, the audience, based on your picks.
Totally normal way of saying that sentence, by the way.
I don't know how to say it. Let's get to the show. Here's our chat with Damon Herriman. And thank you for wandering into the Last Video Store, brother.
Alexi, thanks for having me.
I've been wanting to have you on for so long. Like, this is fun. We've talked about it quite a few times. And finally, we've made it line up at last. You're here in Sydney. You've been performing this great new play, but I've snuck you in here for a second.
You have, yes. Happy to be snuck.
And I wanted to ask you, we usually kick things off talking about video store memories. You're here in the Last Video Store. Take me back. What was the video store you grew up with, or where you discovered the most films?
Goodness, I can't even remember the name of it. I can remember what it looked like. It was quite a small one in Adelaide. I mean, I was a teenager in the 80s, so this was peak
video
home
store
video store stuff. I remember we had our first video player was a Beta cam.
Wow, you're a Beta family.
It was a Beta family, which then just, I mean, people old enough to remember this, the video stores used to have half VHS, half Beta. Mm. And then just suddenly we were like, we're a Beta family. That's great. And then just you saw the Beta options dwindling by the day.
Yeah.
And it was like, Dad, we got to get a VHS. This is not good. There are no options.
Was it hard for your dad to admit defeat?
I think he realized that it was a losing battle to try and keep on with the Beta. We kept recording with the Beta. And you know what? Mm-hmm. Then when we had two, we could record two different channels. Alexi.
Well, that's so what I've heard. Beta, it's a superior. It was the superior item with the Beta.
They did say it was actually the better one, and it was some kind of marketing push that made VHS win through. But yeah, we had a local video store in Adelaide, a suburb called Vale Park, where I grew up, and it wasn't huge, but it had enough of everything. Mm. And yeah, I remember it being a really big part of my weekends, you know, when it was like a special thing to be able to go. And I was really into horror movies. I mean, weirdly, sort of not that weird, I guess, but as a teenage boy, I was very much into horror movies. So the Evil Deads and Class of 84 and all these kind of.
Well, I guess it's like when you're a teenager, sometimes you want to be pressing against that transgression. You want to be like testing what your limits are.
Oh, yeah. And I remember it was a big deal to get the R-rated ones. Mm. Dad had to get sorry for outing you on this, Dad, but you did get us the R-rated ones if we were good.
Don't worry, we've got protective services. Although, not get busted.
Although I remember with the R-rated ones. Because they weren't R-rated sex movies, they were R-rated horror movies. They just meant lots of gore, basically. Yes. But
maybe a titty will get splashed with blood, but it's mainly the blood that's getting the rating.
I remember he did do his due diligence to some degree, and he would watch the trailers at the start to make sure they weren't sex ones. Because they were R-rated videos, so they might have a sex trailer.
The trailer's
at the
like
start.
The canary down the coal mine. He's like testing the atmosphere to see if it's in the right area.
Exactly.
That's so funny. Well, you know, speak of horror, you were in a film that we talked about quite a bit on this show last year, together by the great Michael Shanks. You're playing this great cult leader. What was it like for you, I guess, getting to play in that horror space there on a film like that?
It was a lot of fun. It was a crazy shoot because I was just about to start a show in Atlanta in the US, and I had to be there for this first week. But then they worked out I had about, I don't know, 7 days off before we started filming. And so I ended up shooting that film having just flown from Atlanta and then just shot 5 days in a row, just nonstop. So they shot all of Jamie's scenes, which put me in a weird kind of jet lagged headspace, but it was actually worked out fine. It made me not have to think too much, which can sometimes be a good thing with acting.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah, clears the mind.
It was really, really cool. Michael's amazing to work with. Mm. You know, Alison and Dave were incredible, just so generous and lovely. And yeah, you know, I mean, I don't want to give it away for people who haven't seen it, but you know, the character did have a really nice little arc.
Yeah,
from the time you meet him through to the last time you see him.
On the topic of like video store favorites, one of your early films is a real video store favorite of mine that felt like a complete rediscovery coming back to it a couple of years ago. But the great Nadia Tass film, The Big Steal. Yeah. I adore this film.
Yeah.
Is that one that you think persists for you that you have a lot of fond memories of?
Oh, such fond memories. I mean, firstly, I'd never done a movie before. I'd done TV as a little kid. And I was already a fan at that point of Ben Mendelsohn and Claudia Coven. She was, you know, famous to me from doing High Tide. Yeah,
one of my favourite movies as well. Brilliant. I love High Tide.
Ben from The Year My Voice Broke and other things. So I couldn't believe I was working with them. I was a big Malcolm fan, so I couldn't believe I was working with Nadia Tass and David Parker. I was 19. It's just, you know, going off to Melbourne to shoot a movie with this incredible script. It was so much fun. And, yeah, and it was a semi-hit when it came out, but I think it's kind of – it lived on a lot more and became a bigger film in people's minds through video stores, actually.
Yeah, I mean, it has that feeling. And I think because it's like now in Australia cinema, we don't typically make many comedies like that, like a straight comedy.
We really don't.
It's been a while. I often joke like Kenny was the last comedy released in Australia. You know, there's more hybrids that have happened since, but that's a straight down the line
comedy.
That's
scary if that's true. So long ago.
No, I mean, it's not true. It's me being facetious and probably me being, you know.
Why didn't they make, I still don't understand why they didn't make Kenny 2. That just seemed like a
Kenny number 2. You write itself, you know.
Money, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Kenny number 2.
Makes sense,
that's
man. You got the title.
Good. Just make it for that reason.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe Shane and Clayton hadn't thought about that as a title, and then they would have been more motivated to make it happen.
Guys, get onto it.
Get onto it, please. And I'll be remiss, Damon, if I didn't ask you about this, because this is a video store show. You worked with like the king of video stores, Mr. Quentin Tarantino, playing Charles Manson in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. You know, it's been often talked about that you played Charles Manson in these two projects that came out around the same time with Mindhunter. Can you talk to me about like the different approach to playing a real historical figure for two different and two tonally different versions of that character?
Yeah, oh, that's a great question. Yeah. Well, for one, they were 12 years apart in age. So Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is 1969. In Mindhunter, it's 1981. So he was older. He also, when you look at, you know, old footage of Manson, and I think I've probably seen all of it by the time I was at the
maybe
end of
more
that.
Than most. almost that you'd be happy to know that they were watching that footage.
Yeah, exactly. Look, there was the age thing, but also, you know, before he went to jail, when you look at him in 69, any of the footage before his arrest or even after he was arrested, he's got a happy-go-lucky sort of court jester quality. Mm. He's just kind of like this impish little guy living out on this farm with all these girls who are following his every word. And he's just a very different person from the one that we see in prison. Who
we see more footage of.
Way more footage of that guy. And that guy's really bitter. He's really angry. He doesn't think he should be there. Mm. So there was that, but also, as you say, quite a big tonal difference. You don't get to see it that much, Manson in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Anyone who's got the DVD or even I think the iTunes download, there are a couple of deleted scenes, and the main scene I had, which was my audition scene, is on those. And it's a really funny 2-minute scene where I'm in where I go back to the guest house. When you see me walking off to the guest house in the movie, we actually see that scene. And that scene is really funny. And in Mindhunter, my scene's not funny at all. You know, it's very serious. So it was really fun to get to play those two tonal differences and age differences.
Like separate entities in your head when you're like studying them? Or did you go, well, there's the timeline of this person where you go, this is how I can age this character up or down?
They were sort of separate. I mean, the funny thing was I auditioned for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood about 5 months into researching Mindhunter. Because the makeup took so long to make, they needed like a six-month lead-up to cast Mindhunter. So I got an audition to play a character that I had just been researching for 5 months.
Far out.
Which was crazy.
God, that must be everyone's dream.
Though. Yeah, so it was, you know, it was one of the easier auditions I've done. I just sort of had to go, okay, let me now look at a lot of 69 footage of him and see how different he was. And I was like, okay, he's younger, sort of got a more youthful thing and bouncier or whatever. But other than that, it was the same guy. Actually, and speaking of video stores, interesting, and Quentin Tarantino, the deleted scene also has an actor-writer called Danny Strong. He's actually, if you look him up on IMDb, he's got a lot of writing credits. In fact, he just rewrote the ABBA musical Chess that's on Broadway at the moment. I don't know, he rewrote the book of that for some reason. But anyway, lovely guy. He is the person I visit in the scene, in the guest house. And the reason he got the gig is he worked in the video store with Quentin. They had stayed in touch since then.
Yeah.
And I think actually Danny went in because Danny's really short. I'm only 5'7", but Danny's shorter than me. I think he went in for Manson initially. Mm. And then he was like, oh, do you want to play the guy in the scene talking to Manson? And that's what happened.
Far out. I mean, that's amazing. Well, Damon, it's been a long time coming. I've been so excited to have you on the show because I love talking to you about film. So I'm going to send you out to the store, start wandering, peruse the shelves, bring back a couple of all-time favorites from the weekly section. Then we've got a lovely little new release section over on this side. Mm-hmm. Pick something up from there, come back, we'll talk about them, and then I'll give you the coveted staff pick recommendation based on your taste.
Sounds good to me.
New release.
We'll get straight into it. You've got a beautiful stack of movies here. You have got one from the rarely visited documentary section.
I do.
Especially very rarely visited new release documentary film. A film that I think is quite superb. You have picked up currently Oscar nominated film, up for best documentary feature, Geeta Gandhir's The Perfect Neighbor.
Documentary.
Yes.
For some people who haven't seen this film, I think it's quite remarkable. How would you even describe this film?
Yeah, I was trying to think about that. It's essentially a documentary made up entirely of police body cam footage and some police station interview footage. There are no talking heads, no one sitting there talking to camera. I don't think there's any voiceover from what I can recall.
I think the only voiceover is just 911 calls and stuff that are being put over the top.
Yeah,
so it's very, it almost feels like in the style of found footage.
Yes, you know? It does. And I saw this at the Sydney Film Festival, I guess it was, I don't know if it was the last year or the year before now, but and I didn't really know what I was in for other than a brief blurb on the description. I thought that, you know, I do love documentaries and I do love a really good true crime documentary. And I thought this, if the Sydney Film Festival have picked it, it's going to be good.
There should be something there.
It is riveting. You know, 5 minutes in, you are riveted. You're essentially watching what appears to be just a neighborhood dispute, an ongoing neighborhood dispute between this quite crotchety white lady who lives in this small house across from a fairly black neighborhood, families, kids, having fun, doing what people do, you know, in the street, playing in the street, riding bikes. She happens to live in a house that has some park near her. I think they
almost
say
like an empty lot basically next to it.
It is, and I think don't they say that it is technically her land? But it's
partly. I don't even think it is that. I think the dispute is like it's public space or it's no, space, one's, or so it's no yeah. one's.
It's not. It's certainly not a public park. Mm. But the neighbor opposite her, who has a similar patch of grass in front of his place, has no issue with these kids playing.
Yeah.
But she has a huge issue with these kids playing to the point that she's calling 911 on them all the time.
And that's where most of the footage comes from. It comes from these police body cameras of these cops that are continuously coming to investigate this claim and investigate like what is going on here, investigate these complaints. And what kind of like is shaped from this, I think it's like, I think this is such a clever use of this found footage because it illustrates and paints this picture of like this neighborhood, but then also like paints this portrait of this person as viewed by other people, like how other people see this person and what they're like, what their standing is in this neighborhood, because you're seeing it through the conversation the cops are having with the kids, the cops are having with her, but then the conversation the cops are having with each other, like when they're on the way in, we're like, oh my God, this kind of shit again.
Woman again. I mean, it's amazing. You kind of go, isn't there something where they can go, you're actually now being a nuisance? You know, like clearly you're being, because they're not doing anything wrong. It's not like you watch it going, oh, well, I get why she's, they're just being normal kids playing, you know?
Yeah.
You know, it all sort of comes to a head. At one point, one of the kids, I think, tells their mum that she's taken
something,
their tablet
just
away, or their
rollers,
or threw roller skates at them or something. Yeah. And one of the mums goes over to complain. And I don't know how much you want to give away, Alexi.
I don't know, because currently, I mean, there's some press around this because it's an Oscar-nominated film, but it is a social justice movie in that it's very much about the stand your ground laws in America, which is one's quote-unquote right to defend themselves on their own property.
Yes. I guess we could
say- by deadly force.
Yes. So essentially, without giving too much away, one of the mums comes over to confront the woman and is outside her house, and it doesn't go well, and it's really pretty appalling and kind of devastating. You can't quite believe when your jaw's hitting the floor by the time it gets to that point in the movie.
I saw it in the very much different circumstances to you. Like, I wish I saw the film first, but I watched this on a plane, this movie.
Oh, right.
And it's, you know, a play emotional movie on the plane is one thing. This is one of the most heartbreaking movies I may have ever seen. But seeing it on the plane, there was something, I don't know, that's, when I go on the plane, I usually choose a documentary to watch.
I do too.
This is like, especially something I can just focus in on it. And I'm, you know, sitting on a plane where you're like hitting these marks where you go, shit, man, like I've got to like find new places on my hand to dry my eyes because I'm like just devastated by this film. There's one line in it where you just hear this young boy say like, my heart is broken.
Oh,
and I just remember just like, you know, sitting on this quiet plane coming back from like Brisbane or something and just having to like just try and stifle the noise escaping my head. Just like, ugh! Just,
no, 100%. It's absolutely heartbreaking. The stuff with the kids is just...
was it that made you choose this film? Because I think this is, like I said, we rarely get people picking documentaries.
Well, look, it had to be something from, you know, the last year and that was the one when I went through my head of what I'd seen that had stuck out. You know, the other films I loved. I mean, I loved Splitsville. It was a film that I was considering picking because I saw that at the Sydney Film Festival as well.
Yeah.
And that really... I didn't know anything about these filmmakers or these actors, in fact, apart from the two women in it, leads. Oh, actually, not only the one, only Dakota Johnson.
Yeah, Dakota
was the only
Johnson,
one I think I knew.
Yeah.
And I just thought that was fantastic. I was just blown away. It made me laugh a lot.
Yeah.
And, you know, I love Mighty Supreme, but I thought, you know, that seems a bit obvious to talk about this. Yeah. Surely someone's done that already, have they?
Not yet. Yeah.
But I don't know. I think in terms of something that stood out as being like something that – yeah, that I will never forget. I think Perfect Neighbor was the one.
It's a great pick because it's just a remarkably unique film, like remarkably unique. I love this film, The Perfect Neighbor. It's on Netflix, so Academy Award nominee for Best Documentary Feature. Highly recommend. See it, you know, we've already described it, so see it in a safe position, I'd say.
Yeah.
Because it will devastate you.
Be prepared.
Let's go to your weekly choices, Damon.
Weekly.
You have picked up a movie that I can't believe no one has ever picked on the show.
I can't either. I'm so gobsmacked. I thought that was going to be like, oh, not that again.
This is, I mean, if I have a favorite, like five favorite films, this would be one of them. This is a film that I absolutely adore. I've maybe seen it more than anything else in my lifetime. You've picked up from Martin Scorsese and co-authored by Nicholas Pileggi based on his book, Goodfellas.
Crime.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Take me back to the first time you saw Goodfellas.
Well, I'm old enough to have seen that at the cinema. I saw Goodfellas when it came out at the movies. I think it was based on having seen Margaret and David review it and gave it a great review. And I was like, well, Scorsese and they love it. And I, whatever Margaret and David say, got to go see that.
As they say, as we go.
Yes. I was immediately blown away by everything about it. The story was just riveting. Like from the moment it starts, it's just like you know the starting gun at a race. You know, it just doesn't let up. It's thoroughly entertaining. It's brilliantly directed. It's brilliantly acted. I don't think I really knew Ray Liotta from anything at that point, and so that was impressive. I also was just—I became obsessed with Joe Pesci. I remember for years he'd be kind of—if people would say who's your favorite actor, I'd say Joe Pesci, and it was just based on that performance. I just thought that was—he was just exceptional.
What was it about that performance that drew you in?
Ah, gee, I don't know. He had a. Was sort of not like anything I'd seen before. Just that sort of little kind of whiny, weaselly kind of tough guy, you know, that was terrifying, even though he was tiny, again, smaller than me. But you wouldn't, like, he was terrifying. He was so loose, I think, you know, as an actor, you're kind of just watching that going, you're that guy. I don't know how you're not really that guy. And he was funny. I mean, funny how, you might ask.
I was thinking about it. Yeah.
He just was so funny in that movie.
And it's that kind of menacing line that he plays of you like this guy because you're so entertained by him, but then you hate him because you're terrified of him.
Yeah, I know.
And seeing, like, you know, that moment with Michael Imperioli where he just snaps at him.
Yes.
And the same thing with Frank Vincent, who is Joe Pesci's longtime musical collaborator. They were in bands together. Him and Frank Vincent growing up, they were in bands together.
Wow, I didn't know that.
I think they used to be support acts for Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons and stuff. I think in that Clint Eastwood movie about Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons, I think it's a character that is Joe Pesci in that movie.
Wow.
The other weird Joe Pesci thing that I learned, I watched like one of those YouTube videos that was like 10 things you didn't know about Joe Pesci. And I know a lot about Joe Pesci. I'm obsessed with Joe Pesci like you from a young age. Mm-hmm. I watched this shitty video and it was, no shit, 10 things I didn't know about Joe Pesci.
Oh, it really worked.
It really blew my mind. One of the things I talked about, how he was in a band with like Jimi Hendrix.
What?
Or something. It was like something like that. Where like Joe Pesci was in a band with Jimi Hendrix and then, or he left the band and then Jimi Hendrix replaced him in the band. Something like that. I go, I'm learning so much
stuff. Yeah, right. That's a good one to have up the sleeve.
Yeah, I'll find this video for you. It was a watch mojo that blew my mind.
But also Goodfellas, I think, it's probably still the film I say if people say. I mean, that changes a bit. In fact, I think maybe based on a recent watch, I may now say that my second pick is now my favourite film.
Really?
But Goodfellas, for most of my life since I saw it, was the film I would say was my favourite film and maybe the film I've watched the most, although I did watch The Sound of Music a lot as a kid. But
Different tones.
Yeah.
I think Goodfellas, it's a film that I rewatch very often. Every time I revisit it, I'm convinced within minutes ago, this is the best film that's ever been made.
Isn't it crazy it did not win the Oscar for Best Picture? Do you know what won that year?
Dances with Wolves, Kevin Costner.
Which, I mean, I remembered that Oscars year and it seems crazy now, but I don't remember going, that's a travesty. I remember thinking, Dances with Wolves was great, but that is a movie no one talks about.
No
one ever goes, oh, we rewatched Dances with Wolves the other day. Like, it's just not a movie that comes up anymore.
I would do a wellness check if someone said that. I go, that's a bizarre movie to pick to rewatch.
Isn't it funny, though, that movie was, I mean, it was a huge deal at the time. I guess Kevin Costner was a huge deal at the time.
Yeah, I think it's hard to realize how big of a movie star Kevin Costner was.
Yeah, true.
Like, it's really hard to picture that because, like, you know, he still exists. But it's at that point in time in the 90s, like he was
the biggest,
so
wasn't he?
Big.
For a period there, he was the biggest.
I just can't, I'm from after that time, so I can't quite picture that.
Yeah.
But, you know, Robert De Niro's been my hero since I was like, 9 years old or something.
Yeah.
And so it's such a different thing. With Goodfellas as well, I think it's like that. What I think does so well, it captures the perspective of Henry Hill, the gangster it's based on, so well. That opening line, basically, where the narration kicks in, where he's like, as far back as I can remember, I always wanted to be a gangster. And I think that's such a great line because, one, it takes you back in time to his childhood, but it gives you this, like a lot of people don't grow up in neighborhoods like this where there are these dangerous men that have this allure around them where that can symbolize that's me getting to another level of me escaping the life that I live in.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't live in neighborhoods like that, but everybody has a dream that they've had since they were kids that can symbolize that.
I think that
line is so magical at going, as far back as I remember, I always wanted to be a gangster, taking you back in time, then seeing through, like you literally see this giant big eye of who this kid is seeing those people.
Yeah.
And I think it's just the perfect tone setting to understanding what the allure of those people are.
Oh, and it beautifully romanticizes being a gangster to a point it doesn't.
Yeah.
But I mean, there's some of that stuff of just like, you know, those beautiful tracking shots through the kind of little bars with the little lamps and all that. And you're like, and then, you know, they're being waited on hand and foot. You're like,
gosh,
I want to be a gangster too.
Yes. Maybe I'll try it out. Yeah. Maybe I'll give it a shot. But I think it's like, that is what it is. And when you think about the gangster films, going back all the way to the 30s where it's kind of instilled they have to take this shape and form, they are about the rise and they are about the fall.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is the film that captures how that – why one would want that rise, like why one would want to put themselves in that position to feel that rise.
Yeah.
And then I think the fall is so beautifully exhibited in Scorsese and – obviously, collaboration with all the actors, especially Ray Liotta and Robert De Niro and Lorraine Bracco, but even more so film editor Thelma Shoemaker, Scorsese's longtime collaborator, at kind of capturing that fall with this feeling of like this drug paranoia crash out.
Yes. Yeah. Well, that's right. That's what I was saying. Like the romanticizing part lasts up to a point, and then by the end, you feel like you're going to be sick with the way it's turned out for them. You're like, I don't want to be part of this world anymore. Like, this is not, this does not look fun.
No, not at all.
And it's, the way it's shot and the way it's edited, it's a totally different world from that smooth kind of jazz vibe that we've been seeing in the early part of the movie.
It just, like, puts you so on edge and you just start feeling the pacing while still feeling compelling. It feels like in such a, you know, disgusting, compelling way. We go, I just want to slow down. I can't slow down here.
Yeah.
Are you a big Scorsese guy as well? Have you?
Yeah, I would say. I mean, I'm not, like, crazy, but, yeah, I mean, like, he's just amazing. You know, he's got to be, what, top three filmmakers of all time, surely.
I mean, I would say so, especially living, definitely, I would say.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, 100% living, yeah. I love King of Comedy. I'm a big fan of. And, you know, all the standards, Taxi Driver, Raging Bull.
Can I ask you about Joe Pesci again? When you started going, we fell in love with him in this film, where did you start exploring then and what were the other films that stood out to you to kind of make him one of your guys, like one of the guys you follow?
I mean, I'm embarrassed to say this, but I can't even think what else I watched Joe Pesci. I mean, I saw him in The Irishman, and I was excited to see him in that because it was a comeback.
Fantastic in that movie.
You kind of just, why did he stop? I don't understand why he stopped. Why did he stop before The Irishman? He's been gone for 20 years.
And then he pops up every now and then. I think the last movie he did proper before a semi-retirement was something like, maybe not Eight Heads in a Duffel Bag, but like, something not of note. Maybe it was Gone Fishing, something like that.
Yeah.
But then he's like kind of semi-retires and pays. I think he starts pursuing music again.
Right.
Because he made an album called Vincent LaGuardia Gambini Sings Just For You, which is an album that's kind of from the perspective of his character from My Cousin Vinny.
Wow.
But not really. Like, the cover is that. But it also has, like, songs, like, all these weird songs on there. There's one song called Wise Guy. Have you ever heard Wise Guy?
No.
It's a rap that he does that's basically about his characters from the mafia movies, like Goodfellas, Casino. And the video clip co-stars Naomi Campbell, like, as, like, one of his gangster mole, basically.
Oh, wow.
So, it's, like, him – it's a rap song set to Rapture by Blondie.
Right.
And it's him rapping about, like, him doing hits and killing people and stuff like that.
Quite bizarre.
It's really bizarre. It's, like, quite buried. Like, people don't really know about
Almost
it.
Almost as bizarre as me realizing how few Joe Pesci films I've seen, but I still call him my favorite actor for years.
That's all it takes,
Do you know what's crazy? I mean, you know, there's those – I'm sure this doesn't apply to you. You've probably seen everything, but – I have not seen a Home Alone movie.
Oh,
isn't that crazy?
I think that is actually quite crazy.
But I think it's partly because I didn't feel like I would. I think when that came out, I felt like that was.
You were seeing Goodfellas like same year, you know?
Yeah,
you know, it's hard to do those two at the same time.
I probably thought that was a kid's movie by the time it was out.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's. I know that people just absolutely love those movies, and I feel like I need to catch up on that.
They were huge for me as I was a child. Loved those movies. I mean, that would have been my introduction to Joe Pesci, I hope, unless I saw it wasn't Raging Bull or something when I was two. But I think I would say maybe Christmas time come, give it
pop
a little
it
shot.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, Joe Pesci, one of my favorite actors as well, one of my big heroes.
Yeah, genius.
Your other pick here, you just hinted this actually might be your favorite movie. It's been picked up once before by the great Adam Elliott, Australian animator. But I'm so curious to hear what you think, because I think that this is a film with one of, or maybe a couple of the great performances of all time.
Oh.
You have picked up David Lynch's The Elephant Man.
Art House.
Yes. And I watched it again about 6 months ago, and I was blown away even more than I'd recalled. It's weird because The Elephant Man is not on many best film lists of you ever see. Mm. And it is such a brilliant movie. It is heartbreakingly moving. The acting is astonishing. Which performance were you going to say? Because you could go either way. I know who my pick is.
My first thought is John Hurt, because it's spectacular what he's doing and it's such a feat. But then as soon as within the same sentence coming out of my mouth, I was like, well, Anthony Hopkins is amazing in this film too.
That's who I mean, John Hurt's brilliant, of course. But I thought Anthony Hopkins in that movie, and again, when I watched it again, I was like, oh, this is a flawless performance from Anthony Hopkins. Again, aging myself, I saw that movie at the cinema.
You're allowed to admit your age. Say the number out loud if you need to.
I'm never saying the number out loud.
Yeah. We're going to put your driver's license up on the screen right now.
There's nothing I can do about it. But I saw that at the movies. I was an actual child at the time. But I think I was actually doing The Sullivans, which was a show I did when I was a kid. And the makeup artist on The Sullivans was interested in prosthetics, and he was talking about this movie coming out. And
do you mind if I put a big tumor on your head?
I think he did that sort of stuff too, just for fun. But he was showing me photos, I think, of the making of it and the makeup being done before it even came out. So then when it came out, I went to see it. And this is before Joe Pesci. Anthony Hopkins was my favorite actor from sort of 10, 11, I think it was 11, 11 onwards. From that, I just remember just watching him. I had never seen somebody so not looking like they were acting when they were acting. Mm. Now, obviously that kind of acting had existed, but probably not for an 11-year-old. I hadn't seen any. I was probably just watching kids' movies, Mary Poppins, whatever, you know. And
it's very obvious when Dick Van Dyke is acting.
It is. Yeah. It's even more obvious when he's doing a Cockney accent. Love Dick Van Dyke. There's nothing against Dick Van Dyke. I was just blown away that this guy was sort of seemingly not doing anything but transporting me into the world of this character and what he was going through. I mean, I still think the moment, and it brought me to tears. I mean, that film brings you to tears quite a bit, but the moment when he first sees John Merrick at the freak show circus that he's being kept in, and the camera just slowly moves in on him as he's just looking at him for the first time, it's one of the greatest unspoken pieces of acting you'll ever see.
Yeah.
And so his tear rolls down his cheek. It is it's an extraordinary film, and I made even more extraordinary by the fact that it's produced by Mel Brooks and directed by David Lynch, who I don't think ever produced or directed anything remotely like that before or since. So it was nothing, not remotely in either of their wheelhouses, and it's perfection.
It really is, and I think that's something I remember the first time I saw this film. I would have been a teenager as well, And what struck me as well, like learning that Mel Brooks didn't really want his name to be very present on it because he didn't want anyone to make fun of this movie or make fun of his attachment to it or to consider it to be a comedy.
Did they even say in that recent Mel Brooks doc his name is not even on the credits? Or that just seems crazy.
I don't know. I haven't watched that documentary yet.
Oh, it's really good. I feel like that's what they said, which does seem crazy as the producer. But I know they were saying that he didn't want it to be thought of because he was so famous at that point from his comedies.
Yeah.
And he picked David Lynch purely from seeing Eraserhead.
And I think that's such a, like that shows such great insight into what a genius Mel Brooks is to be able to see someone make something so strange that you can't even think that, oh, that would make sense for this. But he has like this artistic instinct to go, well, I think that guy can access something really deep. And David Lynch is so good at accessing these really deep emotional ideas beneath like this dreamy exterior. Like what is the true like kind of like psychological, I guess, feeling of those things. And I think it translates so well to The Elephant Man. And maybe you said that this film's not on that many best films lists. Partly maybe because his later works maybe overshadow something like this or something like The Straight Story, which are a bit less in that kind of like dream space and more in this kind of reality.
Yeah.
They less signify what his works are.
Yes.
But when you watch The Elephant Man, I think like that dreaminess is inherent to it, you know? Like that feeling of being in this like dream.
Yes. I mean, it has that sort of dreamy, almost nightmarish opening.
Yeah.
Anyone remembers where you're hearing kind of elephants roaring and sort of this swirling smoke and clouds. And then there's that scene that's kind of got a circusy music playing where that creepy guy that works at the hospital gets people to pay him to show John Merrick to them, and they start throwing him around. And that sort of shot in a kind of hurdy-gurdy, kind of dreamlike way. But otherwise, I think it's just a masterstroke that Mel Brooks picked him to direct that. And it wouldn't be – there's no way that would be the same, remotely the same film without him.
No.
Even though it doesn't seem to really show any David Lynchian qualities particularly.
Mm.
But, my God, he just nailed it. And it's, probably still the one film that is guaranteed to make me cry every time. Wow.
Well, we shan't force you to cry on screen right now. But that is The Elephant Man from the great David Lynch. Masterful film. If you've never seen it, what a ringing endorsement to see this. We have now reached that point in the show where it is my duty to give you a recommendation.
Staff pick.
Before we came in, you started putting the pressure on, like, what if we've seen this movie?
Yeah.
I searched hard for something, but more so, I recently just watched this film and it kind of aligned with a couple of things in that are present in your picks here.
Okay.
But I have been, it's not pro, I was about to say,
work on this project. I feel nervous.
I feel nervous too. I feel really nervous too. Especially when I look this film up, it has been reviewed by Margaret and David. So it's in that wheelhouse.
Right.
But recently I've started being trying to like discover films that would be described as like the mean streets of this person's career.
Okay.
So like I think I've put a list together of maybe almost 25 films or something of films I think are like a mean streets, which is Martin Scorsese's early breakthrough film. Mm-hmm. That's like a crime film about like young people and like entering that world. And like when you picked up Goodfellas, I go, maybe there's something in this list. And there was a film that I hadn't seen until very recently as I've been looking through these films, finding something interesting in them. And there was a film that I came across called Laws of Gravity by Nick Gomez.
Crime.
1992, tiny American independent film. Have you heard of this film?
Don't know that I have. I have not seen that. Laws of Gravity. I don't think I know it.
I didn't really know this film at all, and I stumbled across it when I was looking for films described as mean streets, and I found it because I found an old Margaret and David review where they talked about it, comparing it to Mean Streets.
How many stars did they give it?
4 stars from Margaret, 1 star from David.
Well, hold on a second. Why are you recommending me 1-star movie?
Well, it's a Margaret 4-star movie, you know, so it evens out to be about a 3-star.
This is almost the what's the Romper Stomper thing all over again.
I mean, that's almost a Mean Streets movie as well. But there was something in this film that I found like curious, and I watched it recently And then thinking about The Perfect Neighbor, the way this film is captured, it's basically a two-hander. The lives of two incompetent young men from Brooklyn spin out of control after a friend returns from Florida with guns to sell. That's a very crime-heavy description of this film. What it really is two young actors, Peter Green, who recently just passed away, and Adam Treese, who are these young men in this like small town, like small neighborhood feeling Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
And it also stars a very young Edie Falco.
Oh, wow.
And Arabella Field as like their respective girlfriends. So it's kind of becomes this four-hander between these two people and like the kind of lower socioeconomic life that they live and why crime feels like it should be an option. But what it does really, really well that made me think of it when thinking about The Perfect Neighbor, it's shot in this really evocative documentary style handheld way. And
that's why David didn't like it.
That's exactly why David didn't like it. But it's shot by a documentarian called Jean de Songozac, who shot Common Threads, Stories from the Quilt, which is a queer documentary from the 1980s, like a big, big, big queer documentary film. And he's also worked a lot in like kind of TV, Law and Order, Homicide, Life on the Street.
Wow.
I think kind of establishing like those kind of fly on the wall feelings, like these observational documentary feelings. And I think what this film does so well is like it utilizes those where it feels more like not so much a Scorsese Mean Streets, but that early, like almost John Cassavetes, like the way that like you're seeing these real actions kind of unfold.
Right.
What I really love about this film, it has this technique I've never seen before, which is the scenes all play out like these long built out scenes. Whether the improvisation or not, I don't know. They feel very improvised because they feel very real.
Right.
They feel very vibrant between all these young, great actors. But as these scenes play out, the vision stops. So turns cuts to black, the sound continues on for a little bit, and then it opens up on the next scene. And there's something about this thing that really works and climaxes in an incredible way.
It's a black screen while you're hearing
the- Yes, just a little bit as the sound trails out. And there's something about the way that it works in this film, Laws of Gravity, that really I found so
very
interesting.
It feels very 90s indie.
It feels very 90s indie. I was thinking about that. Yeah. It's a film I'd never heard of before. Found this Margaret and David review and I go, maybe that's it. So I don't know if you're into that, jumping back to that 90s indie feeling.
I am. You've got me intrigued.
Yeah, this is Laws of Gravity.
I was worried about David's one star, but when you said handheld, I was like, yeah. That would do it alone.
Yes.
So that hasn't put me off.
This is what David said. He said, Margaret says, David, I have a genuinely did the voice for Margaret. I could do it for you.
Go on, can you?
David, I had a strange suspicion. You're not as keen on this as I am. And David says, well, early because I told you beforehand that I didn't like it. I think it's terribly old hat. Mean Streets, Marcus says he did it better 20 years ago, which is how I found this, which was a very similar but far better film. I find the handheld camera use extremely irritating and pretentious. And I would say that, no, the handheld is what makes this feel special.
Right.
It's probably what I said almost every time David said that in one of his great reviews.
Yeah.
But I think there's something in this. If you feel like exploring it, there's this neighborhood feeling that's not unlike The Perfect Neighbor.
Right.
Meets a bit of Scorsese in Goodfellas. And you can flick it to black and white if it helps
you. To get the elephant man in there. Yeah,
desaturate your TV color. But Damon, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. Truly, long time coming. So happy to have had you in here.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
You're going home with a great stack of movies, The Perfect Neighbor, Goodfellas, The Elephant Man, my recommendation, Laws of Gravity. But I would like to hear about what you're working on at the moment.
Well, I've jumped out of the video store briefly and I'm treating the boards, Alex.
Yes.
I'm doing a play, a fantastic play called Art, written by a French playwright called Yasmina Reza in the 90s, going back to the 90s again, but feels very current despite that. Very funny play, 90 minutes, Richard Roxburgh, Toby Schmitz, just finishing up in Sydney and we're about to tour to Brisbane, Melbourne and Adelaide all the way through to the end of May.
I can't wait to see it because last time I saw you in a play, I was telling you before, was Speed the Plough, which I love that production. I love that play. So I'm just desperate to see you back on stage again.
Well, come along. You'll have a good time.
And you've also got another movie that is screening at South by Southwest.
Yes.
In the States, Australian film, alongside Emily Browning and Jai Courtney. I can't wait to see this film.
Yeah, it's really cool. It's called The Fox. I don't even know how you describe it. It's like an adult fairy tale.
Mm.
It has Olivia Colman and Sam Neill voicing animal characters. It is for adults, though. It's very much for adults.
Don't bring
this
the
movie.
Children along to it.
No, definitely not. And yes, because I'm doing the play, I won't be able to be there at South by Southwest, but I'm very, very excited.
You will still be in the movie. They won't edit you out because you're not there.
As far as I'm aware, it doesn't work like that. I hope you're
That's
right.
what I know. That, as far as I know, too. But Damon, thank you so much for joining me. See you on that stage, brother.
Yeah. Can't wait.
The last video store.
So that was our chat with the great Damon Herriman. Like I said, and he said his show Art is playing in Brisbane, Melbourne and Adelaide. But Em, been getting some nice comments and reviews.
Yes, I was thinking about how we haven't done a listener recommendation for a while, because we for a while they were on a good streak of asking people to leave us a review and their top three picks, just like the guests do, and you would give them a recommendation.
Yeah.
We haven't done it in a while.
We haven't done it for a while because we were doing so many of the good recommendations from the listeners for the, you know, member of the month. What do I call this? Employee of the month.
Yes.
Employee of the month. So let's go back and get some recommendations from me to the listeners.
Yes. So I've got one here.
Mm-hmm.
It is from Btrace14. I don't know if we need to read out the
Btrace14. It's a beautiful name.
This one involves a swear word. So that's no good.
Do a bleep if you must, darling, for my faint ears.
Well, instead, I'll say this. Alexi is the funniest. See you next Tuesday. The pod is a great laugh, but also a great way to explore and appreciate all things film. Shout out for getting me onto Lake Mungo, Ripper. Ooh, underrated Aussie horror. You did the same for me. I love that movie.
Yeah, great movie.
So good.
Thank you to Will Gibb for picking it up.
Yes, thanks, Will Gibb. My combo would be Elemental, The Matrix, and the fifth element or Rush Hour 2.
I know you're going to edit out, but the fish element, that is good. That is good. You know what? I've got something different. So there's this Australian movie, sci-fi thriller, 2024, called In Vitro, from directors Tom McKeith and Will Howarth. Hosted screenings of this at the film festivals, but I'm picking it because sci-fi thriller, a little bit of Matrix-y, not quite Matrix, but, you know, it's a low-budget thriller.
Mm.
It stars Talia Zucker, who plays Alice in Lake Mungo. So she's a star of this movie. She also co-wrote it. It's a really cool little thriller. But what I would best say it does, where I think that I would recommend it to this person too, is to Btrace. Not this person, to Btrace. And why I'm giving a shout out, it's one of those little sci-fi thrillers that is small in scope, but I think that it suggests there's really great things to come from these directors. Like, I think it's a kind of film that you see so many times, this small film that is the starting point and launching point for a really big film career, especially in like that kind of action sci-fi space. So that is my little recommendation, In Vitro. Mm. Cool movie, stars Talia Zucker from Lake Mungo, and also Ashley Zuckerman from Succession.
That's awesome. Yeah. That's a great recommendation.
Cool movie. Check it out. In Vitro 2024. Tom McKeith, Will Howarth. Thanks for joining us, baby. Thanks for that lovely review, Btrace. That's what I meant to say.
Btrace.
But also, what a fun time hanging out with Damon Herriman. Damon, I'm sure, will be back soon one day.
I think he had a good time.
We had a very good time. Go check out his play, but also come check out me at your comedy festivals near you. I will be in Melbourne very, very soon with my show VHS. I'm doing Sydney Comedy Festival. It's sold out, I would say, at this point or very close to, but I'm going to add an extra show. So it will no longer be sold out and you have to please buy tickets again. And also Brisbane and Perth is looking very likely. I'm just trying to find the right dates to make Perth work, because I'd love going to Perth. Perth's beautiful.
It is.
Yeah.
Actually, I've never been, but look, I'm going to assume.
It's awesome.
I've seen pictures.
And thank you to everyone who came to my show at Adelaide. I had such a good time meeting you guys. So, so special. Love Adelaide.
I love Adelaide.
Love Adelaide. Any excuse to go there is great, but thank you all for coming to the show there. I'll see you guys at VHS and stick around for some more beautiful episodes of The Last Video Store. There's heaps more coming down the pipeline.